New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Welcome, I'm Christopher Naughton, proud to be working alongside longtime host Jeffrey Mishlove and co-host Emmy Vadnais. Quick reminder right here at the top, if you would, click on comment, subscribe, or like. It helps get programs like these out to people like you. Well, 15 years ago, I walked into a Borders bookstore, a national chain now lost to memory and history, and I saw this book staring me in the face, Occult America. And the thought went through my head, finally, someone had the temerity, the guts, the determination to say it as succinctly and directly as possible. The author of that book is my guest today. Mitch Horowitz is a historian of alternative spirituality, one of the most eloquent voices of the esoteric in America and around the world today. He is the Penn Award-winning author of many books, including One Simple Idea, The Miracle Club, Daydream Believer, Uncertain Places, and his latest book is Modern Occultism. He joins us today from Brooklyn, New York. Well, Mitch Horowitz, thanks for joining us again. Welcome back to New Thinking Aloud. I know you've been here several times with Jeffrey, so it's good to have you back again. And of course, Modern Occultism out now. It's been out for a few months. I guess in some ways, what is this like coming full circle from your very first book, Occult America?
It really is. I didn't intend it that way, but Occult America was my effort to explore how supernatural and metaphysical religious traditions impacted our country, how they impacted, really got into the groundwater of our country to the point where we all participate in them. Whatever walk of life we're from. And modern occultism is my effort to grapple with the history of the occult as an intellectual and belief-based movement from late antiquity up through the present. So it does feel like a full circle in a way, although when I started, I didn't have that sense.
And in some ways, I guess, you know, and we talked about this, you know, a decade and a half ago, where that word has always been a harsh word. I mean, it's got that hard ending, the last four letters, my goodness. It's almost as if the word itself was used as a pejorative by religious fundamentalists and scientific materialists.
Well, it's interesting. It divides people. Of course, the term occult comes from the Latin occultus, meaning hidden or secret. And it's a term that came into use during the Renaissance as Renaissance thinkers were grappling to categorize the religions of the ancient world, which were being rediscovered during the Renaissance, the pre-Judeo-Christian religions of Egypt, Greece, Rome, Persia, North Africa. And so they settled on the term occult. It's a term that, as you were referencing, it has a very mixed quality in modern life. To some people, it connotes the sinister, but, you know, it also has to be said, just like witchcraft, to some people, there's a certain deliciousness about it, to use a phrase that a witch I know has used. And I use the term simply because it has historical integrity, and I believe in using vocabulary that's very plain, that's very clear, occult, ESP, witchcraft, paranormal. People sometimes want me to change terms to something that maybe is more palatable. But the fact is, I think changing language is almost like changing seats at the table. You're still at the same table, and you got to deal with the guests and what's being served at the table. And I think it's better to be straightforward.
I love the term you use a lot, extraphysical.
Extraphysical. You know, people ask me to define spirituality. It's the extraphysical. Of course, that can go in directions of religion, that can go in directions of magic, that can go in directions of parapsychology. But to me, spirituality is extraphysicality. It's the belief that we're not just flesh and bone. We have a life that goes beyond the mundane.
let's start really at the very beginning, because I noticed that you dedicate your book to Jacob Needleman. And I have to tell you, my life would be different. I know yours would be dramatically different if Jacob Needleman's life and your life had not intersected. You dedicate the book to Jacob. I think it's pertinent to bring it up right now. Who is Jacob Needleman and what did he mean to you?
Jacob Needleman was a great scholar of esotericism and world spiritual traditions. We lost Jerry, as friends called him, about 1 year ago. And he first came onto the public scene in 1970 when he wrote a book called The New Religions. And it was about the new religious movements that either grew out of the 60s generation or were being popularized by the 60s generation, ranging from Zen to transcendental meditation to theosophy to the teachings of Edgar Cayce. And Jerry was just a first-rate scholar and academic, and he was one of the very, very first people to take these new religious movements seriously. In fact, that term, new religious movements, is a term that, if he didn't quite coin it, he certainly helped to popularize it. He was a student of the Gurdjieff work. I published him for many, many years back in my publishing days. He was an enormous influence on me. I would say that if Jerry's life and career could be boiled down to one ethic, it was honoring and venerating the search. Jerry believed very, very strongly that the search for meaning, the spiritual search, the search for self-expression, the search for a sense of purpose, it had to be spoken of in the most hallowed of terms. And it had to be very broad and flexible and open-ended. There's something indestructible about the search, indestructible about a question. And he really taught me to honor that. And I think of him as a formative influence. When he died, I guess I really have to say, I don't think the academic or spiritual culture came to full grips with what it is that Jerry had brought into contemporary life. So I've written about him, and that's why I dedicated the book to his memory.
Well, I know when I was introduced to The American Soul, which to me is, you know, the top of the pantheon of all the books that he wrote, you know, he was the first one, at least in my own search, that said that America possessed a mystical core. A mystical core. And you can hear America described in spiritual terms in many different ways, but no one either had the insight or the guts to come out and say, no, at the very core of American spirituality is a mysticism. And yes. I didn't even know at the time that I read the book. And then, of course, even after, you know, my first interviews with you, again, going back to 09 or 10, I didn't realize till much later, it helps to read the foreword and some of those notes that you had actually. You were the editor of that book itself. So that the American Soul literally left an imprint on your soul.
It did. And that was the first book of Jerry's that I published. In fact, actually, it was Jerry who brought me to ARE, the Edgar Cayce Foundation, for the first time, because there was a small conference there organized around the book entitled The American Soul. That was just after the events of 9/11. And The American Soul is a really remarkable book because his point in that book, as I think you were really capturing, is that the founders cannot be put in any particular box. They had all the flaws of every human being. We don't need to deify them or put them on a pedestal or omit the uglier facets of history. Everything needs to be taught. But Benjamin Franklin, Washington, Jefferson, Thomas Paine, these were people of extraordinary interior lives, and likewise were figures who came later, like Frederick Douglass, Lincoln, of course, and many other such figures who placed a formative influence on the nation. And Jerry really sought to get down to the question of what their beliefs and what their outlook was, not so much in terms of labels or denominations or congregations, but how they understood the search and what they were trying to bake into this new republic and what we lose if we lose sight of those figures, not only as diplomats, statesmen, merchants, and so forth, but as people possessed of a really authentic search of the type that we're not often able to recognize today.
And let's actually dig just a little deeper with that concept of a mystical core. And I know we were talking about he's referencing America, but let's bring that notion of mystical core into the work that you just put out, Modern Occultism.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's something that we're in danger of losing sight of because, frankly, of the culture wars. We, as a human community, are taught to think in binary ways. Now, one of my kids, who's in the very next room, is 16 years old. He's soon entering his last year of high school. He's never learned that Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. He's never learned that Thomas Jefferson devised the Articles of Religious Freedom in Virginia, your home state, that translated into our First Amendment. He's never learned any of these things. And he could tell you about the negative aspects of these figures, of course, and he should know that. But to not know the extraordinary search of these people and what they did to protect the search for meaning, that's to walk around with amnesia. And that's part of what we're facing today.
You know, one of the recurring themes in Modern Occultism is that, and maybe I'm reading into it, you let me know if I've missed it, but what I seem to see is that occultism comes to the fore on the world stage and then recedes. It really is basically going in a wave, but each time it comes to the fore, with it comes enlightenment that can be seen in the culture, whether it's scientific, whether it's civic, an egalitarianism, a justice, seems to come with it, and then there is pushback, and it must recede again, go into secrecy. But do I have it right?
Oh, absolutely. There's a symbiotic relationship in any societies, the U.S. or elsewhere, between the protection of the search, the ability of heterodox ideas to be explored by the individual, and the progress and well-being of those societies in the profoundest sense. So, for example, with the founding of the American colonies, and this is apropos of some of the figures we were just talking about, the colonies very early on developed a reputation as a safe harbor for religious radicals. So a lot of people who, for example, were fleeing a backlash against the occult revival of the Renaissance made the very dangerous voyage across the Atlantic, made it to America very, very early on. This includes the Hermetic monk Johannes Kelpius, who voyaged with about 40 pilgrims from Central Europe to the city of Philadelphia, so-called the City of Brotherly Love, founded by William Penn for the purpose of protecting a relative degree of religious freedom. And this was in the 1690s. And the Kelpius community founded a monastic commune on the banks of the Wissahickon Creek just outside of Philly. And the commune succeeded for a time. And that encouraged other people to embark on similar experiments in the states or the colonies, including the Shaker movement, which originated in Manchester, England, and then found its roots in central New York State, as so many breakaway movements did. And the Shaker movement was a larger, more successful movement. And then you have the Ephrata commune in central Pennsylvania, which again grew directly out of the experience of the Hermetic monks on the Wissahickon Creek. So the nation early on in its colonial period and beyond became a safe harbor for radical religious movements. And you find a flowering of that with the movement of spiritualism, for example, or talking to the dead, seances and so forth, which flowered in central New York State in the mid-1840s. At the exact same time, shortly thereafter, you saw the Seneca Falls Conference for Women's Rights, held also in central New York State, just down the road from where some very public and popular seances were happening, at the home of Kate and Margaret Fox. It's no accident. The spiritualist movement involving mediumship and seances and joining hands to seek contact with the other side, very often its mediums were women. And this was a big deal. This was a big deal because mediums were viewed as leaders of the movement in a sense. And the movement soon had its own clubs, its own newspapers, its own lecture societies, its own newsletters. And it really became a very broad-based civic and religious movement. And it was the first time, or certainly one of the first times in modern life, where women could function as religious leaders of a certain sort. And it was a supernatural movement. It was a supernatural movement that you find these intersections again and again, where almost like a twin DNA strand, esoteric spirituality and social openings occur hand in hand. People have all these sinister associations with the occult, but the relationship between occultism and suffragism, occultism and abolitionism, occultism and free speech, occultism and religious freedom, they can't be separated. They grow together.
Yeah, and even though the term has been used as a cudgel for those who have been seeking the more esoteric and the more occult, we still find that throughout history, as these ideas germinate, as they blossom, we find that there's always pushback, and it can come from the authorities, it can come from religion. Often it comes where there is a marriage between religion and government. Let's go back for just a moment, because I know it bears speaking about even today, of what happened in Bohemia, what happened at the time of the 30 Years' War, because you really, again, give us the roots of occult exploration and how it was really moving forward, and along come the 30 Years' War. And again, I know for some people not in history thinking, why do I need to know this? But this bears witness to some of the things we're experiencing today.
Absolutely. So during the Renaissance, there was a real flowering of experimentation into the occult, alchemy, ancient religious forms. There were iconic figures like the Elizabethan era magician John Dee, or the astronomer Giordano Bruno, who tragically was burned at the stake.
That's after they drew and quartered him, Mitch. Let's get that in proper order.
And this was for maintaining that the sun was at the center of our solar system. This is going back to the early 1600s, not very long ago, by the way, for teaching heliocentricity and announcing chin out that not only is the sun at the center of our solar system, but there are other worlds with other beings. Something that I suspect all of us listening to this today immediately agree with. And this earned you a brutal death sentence in the early 1600s if you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Which really leads to the point that there was a backlash against Renaissance-era occultism, hermeticism, alchemy, mysticism, religious experimentalism. And this backlash occurred throughout Europe, including after the death of Queen Elizabeth, who was relatively liberal in these regards. But after Elizabeth's death and after certain political reversals and changeovers throughout Europe, there was a big backlash against occult experimentation. And this played out chiefly, but most brutally in Central Europe with the ignition of what we call the 30 Years' War in 1618. The 30 Years' War was a little bit like World War I in that there was a mixture of causes. It was a complex series of events that led to the conflict, but largely it pitted Protestant reformist armies against Vatican-backed armies that sought religious retrenchment in Europe. This was a reaction, obviously, to the Reformation. It was a reaction to the various occult and esoteric experiments. And the war proved just absolutely devastating, not only for the generation in which it tore apart Central Europe, but for generations after, because it left the place just a total wasteland, destroyed farms and agriculture and livestock, and there was disease, and there were demobilized soldiers who became pirates and brigands and terrorized that German-speaking part of Europe for decades and decades after the war ended in 1648. But this also resulted in a lot of religious experimentalists leaving Central Europe and coming to the American colonies. And as I was alluding before, these movements took shape here, and they encouraged people that a relative degree of religious freedom that had been unknown throughout most of the old world was available in the colonies. And it's a weird, tragic irony that growing out of that horrible, horrible tragedy grew a migration that fed the religious experimentalism present in the American colonies and that continues to touch us to this day.
Well, you use a phrase which I kind of love in modern occultism, and it's sometimes light must be taken underground.
Sometimes light must be taken underground, and I think that's what's represented by organizations that we think of sometimes as secret societies. And I think, and I dedicate a whole chapter to this in the book, because it's one of the most reactive, most misunderstood responses to the occult tradition to associate the secret society with something sinister. So, for example, in the early 1600s, as this backlash was starting to play out, there was a group or a movement, a secret brotherhood, that referred to itself as the Rosicrucians, that issued manuscripts that circulated through Central Europe. Some were written in Latin, some were written in German, and they proclaimed the existence of a hidden esoteric order of adepts who wanted to reform society, also along the lines that we were discussing earlier. They wanted the protection of the church. They wanted a separation of church and state. They wanted hospitals and public schools and things that built up the public polity and the public good. And people were fascinated. People wanted to join, but this hidden brotherhood was never found. But directly adjacent to it, and a movement that emerged above ground about a century later, is a Freemasonry. And Freemasonry, its radical ecumenism, some of the other traits that I've just referenced, it bore many of the markings of Rosicrucianism. So it's possible that the two movements are related. The two movements actually grew. Freemasonry became the outer face of Rosicrucianism, possibly. Another movement that is talked trash about online, like none other, is the Illuminati, which has this sinister reputation, which I absolutely reject, push back against. And I write about it in some detail in the book, because the record does need to be set straight. The Illuminati was founded in 1776 in Bavaria. It's no mistake that's the same year as the Declaration of Independence. The members of the Illuminati was founded by a lawyer named Adam Weishaupt. They were what we might call Jeffersonian. Again, separation of church and state, protection of the individual search for meaning, radical ecumenism, the rights of different all religions. Thomas Jefferson himself, in a letter of 1800, defended the Illuminati and Adam Weishaupt, and said that saying that the Illuminati was behind the French Revolution or the hidden hand behind governments, he said, and I quote directly, is perfectly the ravings of a bedlamite. Bedlam was a infamous mental institution. and I thought, you know, but the Illuminati was targeted by the monarchy in Bavaria. And there were a series of laws passed against the Illuminati, and the group was eradicated within about 8 or 9 years. They kept records. We have records of who was in the group. Goethe, the philosopher, was in the group. Mozart was close to the group. There were many prominent reformist figures in Europe who viewed the Illuminati as kind of a radical, egalitarian, esoteric group. And this organization, through banishments, through threats of death penalty — I don't think anyone was actually executed, but there was plenty of danger of it — through jailings, was wiped off the books. But once the French Revolution occurred, people who found it difficult to believe that the old world that they knew could be wiped away so quickly and so completely, they said to themselves, oh, there must be a hidden hand behind this. I know. It's the Illuminati. And a whole series of conspiracy literature pamphlets got produced starting in the late 1700s, early 1800s, and it's continued. And this was trotted out after the Illuminati. This was trotted out after the Russian Revolution. Again, you know, the Illuminati was seen as the cause of this conflagration that changed the world so radically and completely. We like to see these dramatic causes in the Illuminati as a one-time, very romantic, renegade, underground, quasi-Masonic group fit the bill. And so I go through all of this in the book. I try to bring out the faces and the names and the people who were involved in the Illuminati, because some of these people, they lost everything. You know, most of us lead lives of relative physical safety. I mean, most of the time, we don't have to fear for our freedom and safety, no matter how much we might like to complain. But we live lives of relative comfort and safety. And to see the letters and the journals of people who were banished, people lost their property, lost their family, all because they stood for ideals that really were not much different from political perspective from what's in the Declaration. It's a tragedy. It's a misunderstanding. So I know, you know, everyone in this kind of repeat loop, this closed circuit referencing, talks about the Illuminati as some sinister group, but the reality is much different.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost as if a cult and Illuminati and Freemasonry are grouped together. In fact, we've got a graphic here on screen that demonstrates pretty much what I think is a popular notion, that there are a bunch of Bilderbergs sitting around a table somewhere with a third eye on the wall, basically determining how they can create a one world government. And right. And look, I mean, not every conspiracy theory is without some merit.
Right.
And no one is suggesting for a moment that the powerful and the exceedingly wealthy are attempting to exceed their power and their wealth. And yet at the same time, it seems to be misappropriated to these wonderful movements, which were for, as you've said, the individual search to that goes back to, again, Egypt, the Hermeticism, goes back to this perennial philosophy that warrants and honors the search. And part of that search, Mitch, is also the ability to doubt, having the freedom to doubt. You know, when I think about, when you speak about the founders being influenced, let's say, the Enlightenment being influenced by this perennial wisdom, they held on to the notion that I can doubt, I can change my mind. And sometimes that's lost upon religious purists, I should say.
Without question. In fact, we were talking about Jacob Needleman earlier. One of the things Jerry said to me that I've always remembered, I would take a questioning atheist above a certain believer. I would take a questioning atheist above a certain believer. And absolutely, I'm not looking for people to be on my team. The only team I'm on, if I'm on any, is the search. And the protection of the individual search for meaning is the thing that I care most about. And obviously that extends to everyone, regardless of whether they live on the opposite side of the street from me in some other way.
Let's talk about another group that was Renaissance-like in its pursuit of the esoteric, and that's the Gnostic Cathars in southern France. You addressed that in your book. Tell us a little bit about them and what happened to them.
Gnosticism is a modern term, obviously, but Gnosticism refers to Mediterranean area groups that formed in late antiquity, after the death of Christ, very often formed an amalgam of Jewish, Christian, and pagan beliefs. They were really remarkable sects and groups, diverse. I don't mean to suggest there was one point of view. Some were more Christian, some more pagan, some more Jewish, like the Essenes. And we like to think in terms of history progressing in these very neat, orderly lines. I'm always a little suspicious of timelines, even as I devise them myself, just to help me and other researchers keep their dates and their epochs straight. And yet, timelines give us the misperception that there are these neat start and stops. And of course, we all know that there aren't. It took centuries for Christianity to unfold, even as the dominant religion of the Roman Empire. The first so-called Christian emperor in Rome, Constantine, he combined Christianity with sun worship. Many pilgrims to the first St. Peter's Basilica would perform genuflections to Jupiter on the steps of St. Peter's until a bishop said to them, "Hey, folks, we don't do this anymore." So these things are messy, and Gnosticism represents one of the most extraordinary epochs of late antiquity, because it shows the searching quality of many of these sects that existed in what we might call the biblical lands, the Mediterranean basin, Egypt, North Africa, and so on. And they combine these beliefs in various ways that were tremendously compelling. And I like to say to people nowadays, if you want to understand Gnosticism, watch the first 20 minutes of the Barbie movie. It's pure Gnosticism. It's waking up one morning and realizing, I live in a fake world. I live in an ersatz world. This isn't reality. And that's what the Gnostics were about. They felt that we live in an illusory world ruled over by maleficent gods who perhaps don't really care about us, don't have our best interests at heart. And there's a greater, truer spirituality in our world to which we have to break through. But we can't do that until we awaken to the illusory nature of the world. So Gnosticism actually amazingly persisted into the Middle Ages. Probably one of the last practicing Gnostic groups, as you were referencing, were the Cathars in southern France, who were completely destroyed, brutalized by a late crusade. Language can't do justice to it. I mean, these people were slaughtered.
I think over a million deaths, something like that.
It's catastrophic.
They had flourished for so long, right, Mitch? Again, you were talking about these things take a while to germinate and to fully blossom, but they had been around a while and basically in some ways were thumbing their nose at the Vatican, correct?
Well, indirectly at least, because they weren't under Vatican control. And if there's one thing that unites the human species, it's having an enemy. And when we don't have a real enemy, we seek one out. We find one. We invent one. I mean, the Cathars are in southern France, more or less minding their own business. They're not necessarily even propagating, but the fact that they weren't under the umbrella of the papacy provided a convenient enemy. And human nature is always in search of a convenient enemy. And again, if we can't find one, we'll invent one, like the Illuminati. And the Cathars were brutally wiped out. It was the last expression of Gnosticism until our own era, you know, really. I mean, Gnostic texts were rediscovered in Nag Hammadi, Egypt, towards the very end of World War II. And that brought to our attention unknown gospels, different iterations of Hermetic writings. Hermeticism is a late ancient Greek-Egyptian philosophy. And we're seeing today in the 21st century a rebirth of Gnosticism, albeit on modern terms, like nothing that's existed since the Cathars.
Let's go back to one of the concepts we had discussed earlier, how the notion that when the occult or the esoteric moves forward on the world stage and occasionally has to recede, but when it moves forward, we see a lot of social movements that reflect greater equality, greater enlightenment, greater egalitarianism, etc. I don't think, and recently I saw you in a video at the Philosophical Research Society sporting a wonderful shirt with Madame Blavatsky.
Oh, I'm wearing it right now. Check it out.
There you go. I must be psychic. But here's another person, if not lost to history, again, castigated, pilloried, ridiculed, etc. Again, almost the kind of name that a materialist or religionist will stick along with the Illuminati, Freemasonry, the occult, etc. But here was a brilliant woman. Yes, not without controversy. But let's face it, without a Blavatsky, we don't have a Gandhi. We don't have a Howard Thurman. We don't have a Martin Luther King. Let's talk about that thread, because to me, it fascinates me, because not only is it interesting from a spiritual view, but what comes out of it culturally and politically.
It's a great question. And Madame Blavatsky is... she'll always be a mystery to us, Chris. You know, the woman, she's an enigma. We as a Western culture will never really be able to digest what she was about. Her dimensions were just extraordinary. She died in 1891, and she's still, at the age of 59, by the way, a young woman. She did so much. She changed the world. Now, look, if you throw her name into Google, the first five search results you'll get will say, she was a fraud. She was a crank. Even worse, you know, she was a progenitor of Nazism, blah, 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 blah. And people believe these things. We believe these shorthand slogans. We think in slogans. We think in generalities. It's an unfortunate trait of human nature. Maybe we have to. It's just a way of categorizing stuff that would otherwise be too overwhelming to walk around with. But the fact is, Blavatsky was none of those things. And as you reference, she was not without controversy, and I write about all this in the book. We have to see her as a flesh and blood human being, with every flaw and bit of ugliness, frankly, that you find in the life of of every human being, along with just extraordinary traits, as you were referencing Gandhi himself. And I'm really careful about referencing this because I want people to realize how authentic this is. Gandhi himself, in letters, speeches, interviews, referred to Blavatsky as first igniting in him the concept of human universality, of religious universality, of religious equality. He met her in London, where he was a law student, in 1889, and she gave him a copy of one of her books, The Key to Theosophy. And he said that without that book, he would not have found his way. And you mentioned Martin Luther King. The King family had a picture of Gandhi hanging over their dining room table. And I had the opportunity to interview King's eldest daughter, Yolanda, who died tragically young in 2005. She had a heart condition. And Yolanda said to me, you know, when I was a kid, I just wanted a normal life. You know, I just wanted to be a normal kid. I wanted to go on dates, go to the movies, listen to records. And I didn't know who this strange robed man was over our kitchen table, but I knew Daddy really doted on him. And King saw Gandhi as one of his chief influences, as the man who helped him marry Christianity to social action. Because, I mean, here's King. His point of reference basically is the Sermon on the Mount. And you're being told to turn the other cheek. And he's asking himself, well, how can I fight social injustice if I'm turning the other cheek? But Gandhi's example of radical nonviolence, radical non-cooperation with injustice, that gave King the bridge he was looking for. There is a family tree there of ideas that goes back to Blavatsky. And I'm just touching on one aspect of her career. You can't contain who this woman was. She was a figure of such greatness and tremendous flaws to match. But I'm really trying to help people understand.
Yeah, I mean, and I think Gandhi even said that it was Blavatsky and her acolytes and colleagues in theosophy who basically led him back to the Bhagavad Gita. He had actually never really gone into it that deeply before. And I think Blavatsky was also, and I think you wrote about this in Occult America, correct me if I'm wrong, that Blavatsky was also really influenced by the American Transcendentalists, by Thoreau and by Emerson. There's this contrary, there's this consciousness, if you will, that has led to what may be the strongest force for good that we've seen in the 20th century. You mentioned it a moment ago. Non-violent revolution, using really the whole notion of the spirit of a Christ, of a Jesus Christ, and taking that out into the world and making change. And again, if not for Blavatsky, we don't have Gandhi, who actually met with Howard Thurman, who was one of Martin Luther King's greatest teachers. And of course, here we sit today, much richer for the Gandhis and the Kings of the world.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I hope readers will enjoy as they're going into the book and into any history book, is that we often think of people and ideas as almost having come fully ripened off the tree. You know, I was saying before that it was centuries until Christianity took any kind of shape that we might recognize in the modern world today, even within the structure of the Roman Empire. There were these combinative religious traditions. And likewise, individuals are they're gradual, they're combinative, they don't come to their point of view immediately. You know, as I referenced a moment ago, Martin Luther King was searching for this bridge from Christianity to social action. You know, he's asking himself, if the meek inherit the earth, then what am I supposed to do? Well, Gandhi gave him the answer, and he found it. And Madame Blavatsky, you know, she was searching the world on the scent trail of some unseen occult or esoteric tradition. She called it the secret doctrine, title of her epic book. And she finally settled on America. She came to America because of the transcendentalists, because of all things, of the work of novelist James Fenimore Cooper, who wrote about native religious traditions in America, and because of the growth of spiritualism. And she said, I saw America as the birthplace of spiritualism, and hence I approached it the same way that a Muslim would approach Mecca. And she saw the United States, where she spent several years and actually became an American citizen, left this country as an American citizen in late 1878 for India. She saw the U.S. as a place that could continue to foster religious innovation. That's why she came here. And I often say to people, for all the problems in our country, as long as we're protecting the search as long as we're protecting the individual search for meaning, we're going to make it. When we stop protecting that, that's when we're going to fail.
You know, Mitch, and again, I'm speaking with Mitch Horowitz today. His latest book is Modern Occultism. And again, the encyclopedic knowledge is sometimes, I'm awestruck sometimes by it. So we can't cover nearly everything in it, and maybe just as well so people will actually go out and buy the book and read it themselves. But I want to throw some notions at you, names, etc. Maybe we can do a bit of a lightning round here. I think one time I asked you to do something in 25 words or less, and you said, I welcome the challenge, but you don't have to. Well, go as deeply or extrapolate as long as you'd like. But let me just throw just some of the notions out that you do cover in modern occultism. Precognition.
We are living in the golden age of precognition. A study that I read about in the book that was produced over the course of a decade at Cornell University shows cognitive statistical evidence for recognition. It's been widely replicated. It was subject to confirmation in a meta-analysis that included 90 different experiments at 14 different, I beg your pardon, 30 different labs in 14 different nations. So if anybody tells you there ain't replication for ESP, boy, they don't know the literature. Precognition, it's something for which we have statistical evidence that is absolutely bulletproof. And it's very exciting to see where this is going to go. It's also exciting to consider ways in which the individual might experiment with it.
The next one is the Aquarian Gospel of Jesus the Christ.
Oh, that is wild. The Aquarian Gospel was one of the first modern works of channeled literature. It was produced by a retired Civil War chaplain, a Church of Christ minister named Levi Dowling, who lived in the city of Los Angeles, published in 1904. It helped popularize the notion of the Aquarian Age, an age of new spiritual enlightenment, according to some theories. And in essence, it's a channeled gospel in which Christ is presented as a universal world teacher. Meshes actually very well with the visions of Edgar Cayce, who was obviously still a very young man when the book came out.
The science and the supernatural. I know you can go on for hours here, but maybe you could just pick out one little segment.
Yeah, you're in danger. We're going to have to do an epic. The science and the supernatural is a chapter that deals with parapsychology, research into ESP, precognition, clairvoyance, remote viewing. I care enormously about these topics, not only because they're the truth in terms of there being a vast body of replicable evidence that support these notions, but it's important to me on another level as well. William James, the great American philosopher, made the statement that he saw no reason why belief itself would not actually cause concrete, measurable, empirically real changes to occur in the life of an individual believer. And if we can come to the warranted conclusion that humanity, all of us, have an extra-physical existence side by side with our physical, that there are extra-physical capacities to the psyche, it stands to reason that that could open us up to possibilities and experiences, real, concrete, actual possibilities and experiences that wouldn't be there without that warranted belief. And so I try to really distill the concrete, replicated, remarkable onrush of evidence that has come to the support of the existence of ESP, precognition, and so forth over, well, I'll say since the early 1930s, when the great scientist J.B. Rhine opened the parapsychology laboratory at Duke University. It's a tremendous moment on the Western scene because it's really the first time here in the United States that a parapsychology lab opened under the auspices, under the umbrella of an academic institution. And since that time, our research into parapsychology, right up through the present day, has just been extraordinary. And people, they need to know about it because, again, as with Madame Blavatsky, unfortunately, you ain't going to get it on a Google search. Wikipedia, which is a great resource in a lot of ways, is terrible when it comes to parapsychology. There are organized groups of people who know Wiki inside out. It's a system like any other system, and you can kind of work it. and organized groups of denialists, rejectionists. Spike, most of the articles touching on parapsychology and the lives of its pioneers on Wiki. And so, unfortunately, there's not a lot of great places for people to get info. So I try to provide that info in a way that really stands up. Lots of references, and I encourage people to check out those references and hold me to the fire. You know, I mean, if I'm exaggerating, give it to me.
The name Henry Steele Olcott.
One of my heroes. Henry was a colonel for the Union Army in the Civil War. He was basically an investigator of fraud among military contractors. That was the man's job. Henry was one of the first investigators in the Lincoln assassination, made some of the first arrests and interrogations of suspected co-conspirators with John Wilkes Booth. And Henry, in 1873, made the acquaintance of an extraordinarily eccentric, strange, alluring, world-traveled Russian woman named Madame H.P. Blavatsky in state of Vermont, where they were both visiting a so-called haunted house, and to put it shortly. And the two of them got together. They became partners, not romantic partners, but intellectual partners. And here in New York City, where I'm speaking from, they co-founded the Theosophical Society in the fall of 1875, and it changed the world. Everything we've said about Madame Blavatsky could be said about the Theosophical Society, and among other things, it ushered in the worldwide revolution in alternative spirituality.
One more, and then we can go back to general discussion here. Psycop.
Oh, Psycop. Yeah, Psycop sees itself as a skeptics organization. They were formed in the early 1970s to debunk claims of people like me and you and anybody who's interested in the extraphysical. In my estimation, they've done a terrible disservice because they've taken a label, skepticism, which is a noble label and a good label, and they have morphed it into something else. They have morphed it into rejectionism, denialism, refusal of evidence, even to the point of suppressing some of their own evidence when it cuts against their sentiments and their ideology. There was a big scandal in Psycop, which is now called the Committee for, Committee for Scientific Investigation. I forget it. It slips my mind for a moment, but the name has changed. In any case, Psycop, in the mid-1970s, conducted some statistical tests having to do with astrology, obviously with the intent of discrediting astrology. And unfortunately, they got back something that confirmed rather than discredited astrology. So in short, they squelched their own findings. It's the absolute opposite of skepticism. It's the absolute opposite of questioning, of searching. They failed to report their own findings because the findings didn't comport with their prejudices, and split the group apart. Although, for all that, the group has been very, very successful. They gave birth to the people who were spiking the parapsychology pages on Wiki. They've been very effective.
Right. And the amazing Randy, of course, a member of Psycop for many years.
Well, you can read all about him in my work. Yeah.
Yeah. He's all over your work, but you gave one of the more eloquent responses to his legacy as well. And I just recommend, we'll put a link up on this program, which can take you back to that article that Mitch wrote several years ago. And as well as some other articles as well. You know, Mitch, 2024 is going to be a big year for the United States, and it's going to be a big year in the world. But before I get to that, and here's the thread. You know, sometimes, what did Bob Dylan say? Some things occur by simple twists of fate.
Yeah.
I have to wonder. And you've talked about both of these issues, and I'd like you to share them with the audience today. The kind of what if, I mean, what if America had adopted, let's say, Thomas Jefferson's attitude towards the Bible. I know the Jefferson Bible was never meant to be distributed nationally or on a broad scale basis. And yet you have to wonder, this man who went into his study while he's in the White House and basically starts ripping up and tearing up the Bible, which of course is heresy to many, but he basically was taking the canonical gospels and putting them in an order that made sense to him. You talk about a radical spirituality. This was a singular spirituality. And I have to wonder, And again, it was about the words of Jesus, not the story about Jesus or what Paul said about Jesus or the miracles, that sort of thing. It's basically the red letter gospel of Jesus. And you've got to wonder, and I know you have because you've been interviewed on this issue many times, what might have happened to the trajectory of American spirituality if America had, and maybe still will, adopt that approach to the canonical gospels, to the man we call Jesus?
Well, Jefferson was such a complex man, and his spiritual search was so rich. In fact, I've thought from time to time about writing a whole book about the spirituality of Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson, he was not an atheist. He was not an atheist, but he was what might be called a deist. He believed in a creator, but he believed that once the work of creation was done, humanity was left largely to its own devices. And his own denominational affiliation was Unitarianism. And he believed that one day Unitarianism would be the dominant religion of American life. Well, that turned out not to be so true, but he did foresee another dominant trend in life, American religious life, which is people saying they're spiritual but not religious. People run down that position sometime, but in many ways, I think Jefferson, he represented the ethos of that, which is to say that the ethos of the search without any hardcore denominational affiliation. He did believe in the figure of Christ as an authentic figure, as an actual being, and he used textual analysis to support that, very similar to what some theologians who agree with him do today. He said, if you look at the four Gospels, you'll find a definite, consistent, determinative voice that vanishes when you get to the book of Acts, that voice animating scripture is gone. And in those specific sections that became canonized, he says that voice, it exists, it's there, it resounds. And he didn't believe in the miracles attributed to Christ. He felt that those were, propagated to convert people, but that they weren't real, but that the ethics of Christ were the extraordinary component of his life. And that so, you know, as you were alluding, he cut up the four Gospels to form one compelling book, which he kept private to himself. And this book tells the story of Christ as it appears in Scripture in linear chronological order, but it presents Christ not as miracle worker, but as ethical philosopher. And it's an extraordinary document. It really is.
And written in English, French, Greek, and, oh, by the way, Latin as well. You know.
Can you dig this? English, French, Greek, Latin. And, you know, while you're at it in your spare time, would you write the Declaration of Independence, and would you codify the Virginia Articles of Religious Freedom? And because, right. You mean, yeah. It's hard to encapsulate these figures, but, and it wasn't that long ago, true. You know.
It wasn't that long ago, and he was a scientist as well.
Scientist, right. University administrator. I mean, any one of these things would give you an obituary somewhere, but, you know, the list goes
on. I have to just say, because my son went there, we're not that far from UVA, but, you know, we've interviewed and worked with alongside Bruce Grayson and Jim Tucker and those at the University of Virginia, you know, Department of Perceptual Studies.
Department of Perceptual Studies. You know, Jim today runs one of the greatest academically based parapsychology labs our country has ever known. And this is happening right now. So it's significant work. And I write about it in the book because I want people to be aware, too, that this stuff is going on right now in our own time. And we can be part of it and be current with it.
I think TJ would be very proud of that. Mm-hmm. But can I speak for the men? No, I cannot. Another what if. Okay. And you talked about this in Occult America and you raise it again in modern occultism. What if Henry Wallace, the Theosophist, and other things as well, had remained as FDR's vice president, and instead of Harry Truman being inserted at the last minute, again, you talk about simple twists of fate, what might have happened? Let's talk a little bit about Henry Wallace, what he meant, his spiritual path, and what that might have done to America's trajectory, both politically and spiritually.
Well, Henry Wallace he started out as Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of Agriculture, saved thousands of family farms during the Great Depression, probably the greatest Secretary of Agriculture this country has ever had. He later became FDR's second vice president, preceding Harry Truman. And Wallace was just such an unusual being in American politics. He was very, very open, very unembarrassed about his spiritual search. He was interested in theosophy. He was a member of the Theosophical Society at various times in his life. He was interested in astrology. He was interested in reincarnation. He was interested in Tibetan Buddhism, a very, very wide strands of occult, new thought, alternative Eastern spirituality. And the thing about Wallace that I truly, truly love is not just that, oh, well, gee, isn't it nice that there was a vice president who was interested in the things I am, sure. You know, one could always wave a flag for one's team, but that's not important. What's important about Wallace is he really honored the search. He was unembarrassed by the search. He was transparent. He was forward with people. And if you can call this a mistake, I don't know whether you can call it a mistake, but the one thing that he didn't count on, and this is a tragedy of the man's life, is that he was unable to see that other people, the press, some fractions of the public, were just simply incapable of understanding the integrity and the seriousness that he brought to his search. So when things came out in the press about Wallace's interest in occultism, which included his collaboration with the theosophist and artist Nicholas Rorick, he was described as a drooling mystic, a bubblehead, a weirdo, somebody who couldn't be trusted behind the wheel. And for a variety of reasons, some of them also political, FDR more or less, he softly pushed Wallace off the ticket when he ran for his last term of office. He failed to defend him. And Harry Truman was named in Wallace's place. So it's Truman, of course, not Wallace, who's remembered by history. What would have happened is one of the great what-ifs of history, because it involves not only the question of bringing the Second World War to a close, but the question of relations with the Soviet Union. And it's of course, a what-if that none of us can ever know. But I write a lot about Wallace, both in Occult America and in Modern Occultism, because he was such an exemplar of the search. He was such a great man, and he was a man whose political career foundered, not because of anything he did wrong, but because he just didn't understand that other people who were not as dedicated to the search as he was were incapable of understanding, grasping the seriousness, the sobriety, the realness that he brought to the search, and they were more comfortable just thinking of him as some weirdo.
I know that you have issued prognosticating in your life. You've smashed many crystal balls and sacred cows along the way.
Yep.
But I'm going to try to corral you a bit today, if that's even possible. It's a big year. It's a big time that we're in. And, you know, as we have seen, as you've stated, sometimes when occultism comes to the forward part of the stage, there is often a pushback. We see that in our own time. But I would like us to opine a bit as to what impact the growth of the occult, the growth or the acknowledgement of mysticism, the greater awareness of consciousness and scientific realities of consciousness, what impact, if any, do we see that having in America primarily, but around the world as we move forward into this period of crisis, this period of perhaps constitutional crisis in the world? What, if any, impact can it have, will it have, might it have?
Well, I'll say this. I had an interview a little earlier today before you and I got on the line, and it occurred to me that if there's one issue in front of the public eyes that's truly and authentically bipartisan at this moment in history, it is UFO disclosure. And
you just took my next question, but go ahead. We wanted to talk about
it. I mean, look, you talk to any legitimate advocate, researcher, experiencer, and if they're interested in the politics of disclosure, big issue for us all today, everybody, there's no political labels that are standing in the way. There might be other things standing in the way, but political labels are not one of them. I have never, on any issue in my lifetime, seen so plainly a collaborative spirit among those handful of people in public life who really care about disclosure. And one of the issues, one of the things I've tried to get across to the searching community, to the UFO researching and seeking community of which I am part, is that, you know, we get torn apart by a lot of different suspicions, sometimes paranoia, sometimes differences in analysis. Not only is that going to slow down our progress, but it will detract from the extent to which that movement, which is having its public moment, can at least provide a model of possibility. It may seem far-fetched. It may seem idealistic. I don't mind being called idealistic. I want to be called idealistic. I think that community can provide, is providing, at this precious, precious moment in time, a model of how you can publicly pursue a question without these old categories tearing us and eating us apart. As you said, we are in for one hell of a year. I don't know that it's even really settled on us yet, because it's coming like a speeding freight train, and it's going to be a tough year. Now, the only thing the individual has agency over is him or herself. And one of the things I often say to people is, we as a human community, we will not make it if we don't turn down the heat online against one another. Somebody once said, Twitter is not real life. Well, of course it's real life. It's as close to a public square, an international public square, as we have. And we've got to turn down this heat, and it will help the individual too, because people sometimes come to me and say, you know, I'm depressed, I have a poor self-image, what should I do, et cetera, et cetera. Well, there's all kinds of things that you can do, but one of them is desist from trash talk, desist from attacking other people, desist from this kind of, just this angry, very ordinary stone throwing, the invention of enemies, speaking in sarcasm, speaking in rhetorical questions. It's not only tearing us apart as a polity, but the individual actually does feel shame for this, I believe, and he or she sublimates that shame the same way that an addict does. It's like, okay, go back to the bottle, go back to the needle, go back to gambling, whatever it is, you know, that the addict suffers from. And it's a hell of a poor way to live. And desist from trash talk for 1 hour, 1 hour, and see if you don't stand taller. So these things are not cotton candy. This is not confectionery. These are things that not only help the polity, but they help the individual.
One of the experiences I've had since working with Jeff and Emmy and the group here at New Thinking Aloud, you know, I did the radio program for many years off and on, just really as a side passion. And it always was about spirituality and consciousness. Not once, Mitch, not once in the 20 some odd years I did a radio programming did I ever talk about UFOs. It was just way out on the outer edge.
Yeah.
And I just want to pose this to you, because what I'm learning or I've been exposed to is that UFOs, it's just part of the, if you will, extra-physical continuum.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, I totally dig. Those conversations are conjoining, you know, because I think, I mean, if you grow up to the extra-dimensional thesis, which I do, you start to really deal with these questions of the psyche's ability to receive information, receive data from other intersections of time. And that really touches on the whole precog psi thesis, and you start to have a very similar conversation. So I think those worlds are converging. It's exciting, you know.
There are times in cycles in history where the occult and the esoteric play a more prominent role on the world stage. Maybe this harkens back to the beginning of my question that I just asked. Are we living in that time period of the cult moving towards that more prominent place on the world stage where it is more easily accepted? Maybe the occult is not so occult anymore. We go right back to the very nature of the word being secret or hidden, much less secret, much less hidden. How does that impact us? How does it impact our consciousness and what manifests from that consciousness?
Well, you know, I was talking before about how the UFO issue is one of the very, very few bipartisan issues. Sounds like an old-fashioned word to use at this juncture.
Yeah.
But it's a word we used to use when I was a kid. We've almost forgotten that it's humanly possible. But It's one of the few issues that goes beyond political borders. Well, you know, there are many such issues within the spiritual life that go beyond political borders. You know, for example, I mean, well, there are certain books, certain figures, certain attitudes, like thought causation, positive thinking, call it what you will. I shy away. I don't like the term law of attraction because it's not my point of view, but I do believe that there's mental causation. If you talk to people about these things, you'll find that they unite people across very diffuse cultures, from New Age growth centers to evangelical media ministries. And it's really remarkable to get people into a room, and if they have similar experiences, whether it's parapsychological, whether it's some of these non-sectarian religious movements like positive mind metaphysics, whether it's the UFO question, there's no inherent politics at the back of any of this. At least that's my argument. And the constituencies of those movements support that argument. And I don't have a heck of a lot of faith in human nature. I think human nature is pretty ugly. We look for enemies. We believe in our idealized views of ourselves. We're very happy to point fingers at other people. We very rarely look in a mirror. We thrive on a kind of us versus them thinking. We're all the hero of our own story, which can be a very destructive way of thinking. Whereas the real mirror of our lives is relationships. If I want to know what kind of person I am, I can talk to my kids. I can talk to my partner. They'll tell me the truth. My own lovely stories about myself ain't what's going to tell me the truth. So look, what I've just described is one of the key principles of AA, one of the key principles of the recovery movement, of the 12 steps. The great Bill Wilson, co-founder of AA, used to say, you know, you don't see progress in yourself. You see it in other people's reactions to you. They'll see it first, you know. And so those principles can be a help, can be a help. Human nature is a very tough, problematic creature. But those principles can be a help. And again, you know, if the individual wants to do something to help the world, don't be abstract about it. You know, there's many things that you may be able to do, but one thing you can do right now, immediately, is unplug this trash talk. You know, I'm on social media all the time. I'm on Twitter or X, Instagram, YouTube, which really is a form of social media. Turn it down. You know, it doesn't mean you can't be blunt. Nobody would ever accuse me of not being blunt. But I don't engage in this trash talk, gossiping, rumor, running down of people's reputations. I won't do it. And to the extent that the individual can try that, again, you're not only helping things in general, but see what you feel. See what you feel after 24 hours. It's going to make a difference in your life, concretely.
Well, it may please you to note that currently on your Wikipedia page, there's no mention or castigations of pseudoscience or a New Age babble or anything along those lines. So I know what you mean.
I don't know if I want you to broadcast that, you know, Christopher. It's
No, I understand, but it seemed like a fair assessment of where you are, where you've been, and again, always great catching up with you. I have to ask you: did you ever finish the One Step Beyond series? Did you get to the end of that great television
show? I watched a lot of them. I love this because you're one of the only people I dialogue with who knows the show One Step Beyond, and most of it is free on YouTube. I probably watched about 90% of them. It's a hell of a lot. I love the show.
It is. I mean, near-death experiences, reincarnation, you know, all the things. And again, for the uninitiated, they may not know that as opposed to The Twilight Zone, which was science fiction, all of these stories purported to be true. And the very last one they did actually was on Sacred Mushrooms. And
One of the few actually documentary style versions of that show, and it's really worth watching. If you throw into your search box One Step Beyond Sacred Mushrooms, you'll find it. And and a lot of the show, you know, as you were alluding, it was based on authentic reportage of parapsychology that appeared in the various clinical literature, and I've checked some of it out, and And it stands up. You know, some of these cases were out there in the research realm.
Well, the latest book is Modern Occultism, and I've been speaking with Mitch Horowitz today. Always a delight. I always learn a lot and a little bit of mirth and laughter thrown in. Mitch joining us today from Brooklyn, New York. Mitch, it's always great having you here. And the nice thing about your tomes, which are, again, I don't want to make that sound like it's stodgy. It is a tome in the sense that it is so rich and compelling, like many of your books. And I know that means we'll have fodder for more conversations in the future. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
And for all of you watching today, we appreciate you being here. Again, we remind you, take a chance. Go ahead and click on subscribe or like or comment. It gets programs like this out to a much greater audience. And for all of us here at New Thinking Aloud, for longtime host Jeffrey Mishla, for co-host Emmy Vadnais, all the great volunteers, I'm Christopher Naughton. Thank you for joining us. You are the reason that we're here.
I imagine that by now, many of you already realize that, in conjunction with White Crow Books, we've just launched the new Thinking Aloud Dialogues book imprint, and our first title is There Life After Death? New Thinking Aloud is a nonprofit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.